Welcome to History of the Symphony, recorded live at Grace Methodist Church in Baltimore. Now here's your host, Evan Tucker.
Beginning of the class, we're going to talk about a lot of composers today, not just Beethoven, though Beethoven is the subject of this class. We have a popular image of Beethoven on the scene in our minds. When you think of Beethoven, what do you think of? Big, powerful, yes. You know, a giant, you know, the colossus, you know, who put his autobiography into his music. But here's the thing about Beethoven. That particular Beethoven is only one small part of his personality, of his biography, of his oeuvre, whatever you want to call it. And that really, in the symphonies, only exists until about the Sixth Symphony. The last three symphonies, 7, 8, 9, I mean, all three of them are obviously great. But at least in my opinion, and certainly the ninth in the opinion of a lot of people, the last three are almost as though they're written by a different composer. You know, he made each of the last three symphonies are three very different styles to everything that came before, and he was trying to create different ways of writing a symphony, and he never had time to follow up on any of them to write other symphonies in those particular styles. So you could almost say, for example, that the Seventh Symphony, to me at least, is like the first symphony of Schubert or of Bruckner. And the Eighth Symphony is almost the first symphony of Mendelssohn or Brahms. And the Ninth Symphony is almost the first symphony of Berlioz or Mahler, even Charles Ives. We're gonna talk about, obviously, all of these composers in different classes. And we're not even really going to talk that much today about the Fifth. We talked about it somewhat last week, and we're going to keep talking about the Fifth pretty much all the way through. So there's no real reason, you know, to devote that much special attention today. The real focus of today is going to be the Eroica and the Pastoral. Now, don't worry, there's lots of stuff to do today. We're going to talk about the way that Beethoven's performed, and we're going to sample different performances. We're going to talk about the way Beethoven composed versus the way Mozart composed. We're going to talk a lot about the French Revolution and its enormous impact on Beethoven. And a little bit, sadly, about, you know, contemporary America. But we're going to listen to a little Renaissance music. We'll listen to a little Broke, a little Chopin, even a little Miles Davis. And please don't get scared, but we are even going to talk a little bit about music theory. Now, let's think for a moment about what Beethoven was going through when he wrote his first symphony. Now, the second symphony, not the first, I'm sorry. The first symphony is great, but, you know, it's more Haydn than it is Beethoven. And it's not necessarily even Haydn at his best. It's light, it's frothy, it's sort of a piece of fluff. It's an amazing piece of fluff, but it's still fluff. And a lot of people feel the exact same way about the second symphony, and they think that it's not even as good as the first symphony. I don't know what these people are smoking. I always hear these people complaints and wonder if we're hearing the same piece. Because to me, this is the music of somebody who's clearly just barely holding it together. You remember from the end of the last class, we did the first 2.5 minutes of the Haydn London Symphony, the last symphony. Remember how dark that music was? Beethoven takes Haydn 104 here to its next logical step. You know, in Haydn, there is always a balance between light and darkness. Every time there's dark, he contrasts it with light. In Beethoven, it's not a contrast. He threatens life with darkness. You know, the storm is always gathering, and the sun can barely peek its rays out over the landscape. So we're going to listen to the beginning of Beethoven 2 in a very old performance. And before we go any further, I just want to put in a word about about what we call historical recordings, because this is going to be a recording from 1943 in Amsterdam during the Nazi occupation. You know, it's true that before the 50s, the sound of recordings is always much, much worse. But, you know, recordings before the 60s come from a period where classical music was the music that a majority of the middle class listened to. And so the audiences knew the music better. They listened more intelligently and more critically, and the music meant more to them. And technically speaking, a lot of the musicians from that period couldn't hold a candle to the techniques of musicians today. You know, today it's down to a science, but they had to bring their A game because of their audiences. And they played not just with more heart and soul, but they played with more brain too. I'm going to refrain from any comment about the intelligence of the average classical musician in 2017. But you can pretty much figure out my opinion when I say that it used to be a given that the best performers would bring their own ideas to the music in the same way that, you know, and they would put their own spin on it the same way that, say, a jazz singer would on a jazz standard. And hundreds of thousands of people would compare some musicians to other musicians, you know, in just the same way that the World War II generation, you know, would fight over whether Ella Fitzgerald or Billie Holiday or Peggy Lee or Lena Horne sang Fever the best. And in the same way that there was an interwar generation, you know, which would fight about whether Rubinstein or Horowitz or Rachmaninoff or Josef Hoffmann played the best Chopin mazurkas or polonaises. And that extended to conductors in Beethoven symphonies too. And there are names that, you know, are not much remembered except for weird nerds like me. You know, Toscanini, Mengelberg, Bruno Walter, Otto Klemper, Wilhelm Furtwängler, Eric Kleiber. These are just some of the names of that period. And, you know, in the period before that, let's just say you were a music lover in Germany. If you were so inclined, you could travel to various cities and you could hear Beethoven conducted live by Mahler, by Richard Strauss. And even before that, you could hear it conducted live by Wagner, by Mendelssohn. If you were living in France, you could even hear it conducted by Berlioz. So let's hear the first couple minutes of Beethoven II, conducted by what I think is one of the greatest conductors who ever lived, Wilhelm Mengelberg, who's not much remembered today. So we'll just listen to the first two or so minutes.
Thank you.
So that's going to bring us to the first duality of the class. We're going to call this diatonicism versus chromaticism. In order to understand what we just heard, we just need to delve a little bit into the rules of harmony. And I promise we're going to keep this very simple. We just need to know two terms, diminished chords and chromaticism. So everybody knows a major scale. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Baby simple. So when I say a triad, do people know what I mean? Very simply, C major scale, triad. Okay, so then, you know, you get something like you get in Duke Ellington, Take the Atrium. You can see I'm not a pianist. None of that is chromaticism. That's diatonic, and that's the limits that sort of the dissonance you get in diatonicism. Then, most music has basically two magnetic rules. There's the tonic, and then there's the dominant. So, you know, this is, and all music in common practice tonality exists between basically these two poles. Now, chromaticism is a completely different conception of music. And it only exists sort of in the periphery of music, in the periphery of American music. It's sort of a European plant. And when Americans hear chromaticism, for some reason we associate it with something that feels louser than what most of us are comfortable with. Think of how many of you know the album Kind of Blue, Miles Davis. You know, this is the singular moment in 1959 when jazz became something other than mainstream music, while Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley were, you know, still completely in diatonicism. So here's the beginning of Kind of Blue. So then it gets famous. Or listen to this bass line from the 17th century composer Henry Purcell. That's Dido, the great tragic heroine in the Aeneid, who commits suicide after she's left by Aeneas and sings her lament of a broken heart. Now, Purcell was another one of those musical geniuses like Mozart and Schubert who only lived long enough to show us the smallest bit of what he was capable. But what he does is gradually descend by the smallest intervals on a keyboard. It's literally the music of like a gradually worsening mood and a mental state that finally hit solid ground enough, just enough to communicate itself, only to repeat the process over and over again. It's the perfect metaphor in music for a downward emotional spiral. Or take this from an aristocratic composer named Carlo Gesualdo in the Renaissance, who not only knew about unrequited love, but did something about it. He caught his wife in bed with another man and murdered them both. But you hear those first few chords. It moves chromatically both in the treble line and in the bass. So, you know, it's almost crazy sounding. And you can instantly understand this composer's desperation, and you can probably imagine him committing murder. You know, it's like the walls of the intestines are tearing up. Now, chromaticism is going to come up over and over again in this class, but the question still remains, what does it express, if anything? So I could try to come up with a more specific explanation, but instead let's defer to Leonard Bernstein.
Etude. Imagine being sexy in an etude. Hear all those implied harmonic gorgeousnesses, and the implications all arise from ambiguities. Are we in the major or minor? Is this tonal or modal? Are those ninth chords or diminished sevenths? Is it the Phrygian mode? Now, you may not understand one word I've just said, but no matter, as long as you feel how this music hovers between something and something else. That's enough. You feel the ambiguous quality.
So, the point of chromaticism is nothing more than musical ambiguity, and ambiguity being what it is, may not have any purpose at all. So, but the point is, with Beethoven, chromaticism, the resolutions are 100 times more complicated than they are in Haydn and Mozart. So, they're symptoms of like an emotional pain that has in some way to be transcended. So the way that Beethoven does this is through what we call a diminished chord. And let's go again to Leonard Bernstein to explain the context of a diminished chord.
These four tones, G sharp, F, D, and B, happen to form a diminished seventh chord. Now don't fret, I'm not going to explain that. But it's worth your knowing that the diminished seventh chord is the most ambiguous of all tonal formations. And for that reason, it became the favorite, even basic, ambiguous chord of all the Romantic composers. Maybe I should explain it a bit, after all. Every diminished seventh chord is capable of at least four different resolutions, which gives any such chord a minimum four-way ambiguity. Now, take this one we were just looking at, for instance. It can resolve here. And it can resolve here. And it can resolve here. And it can resolve here. At least those four. There are many more resolutions I won't go into. No wonder the Romantics seized on this chord. It's so wondrously useful for all ambiguous situations, such as moody meandering. Where would Tchaikovsky be without that? Or noisy confusion? Where would Liszt be without that? Or abrupt dramatic suspense, as in Carmen? Suspense, tension. What's going to happen?
So now that we hear that, let's listen to a little bit of this introduction.
Thank you.
let's listen to the end of the same movements. And, you know, what he does here is he literally piles diminished chord after diminished chord after diminished chord. It goes through all sorts of different keys just in a matter of 15 seconds. Brings us back home to the home key. Now, remember how we talked about transcendence in the first class? I mean, music doesn't get more transcendent than this, and I don't mean this in a factual way, not a subjective way. You know, he creates the greatest imaginable dissonance that anyone knew how to conceive in 1802, and he transcends that dissonance in order to bring resolution to it and get us back. So, what in Beethoven's personal life at this point might he have been transcending? Yes, yes, he was deaf. Anybody who writes music like the Second Symphony is not a person you want to spend more than a small dose of time with. Beethoven was, of course, a wild man. He had a hair-trigger temper. He was known for sending restaurant food back to the kitchen via the waiter's head. But he was also, in many ways, a friendly man who wanted to live his life morally and with concern for people. So this brings us to the second duality, the personal versus the political. So I'm sure many of you remember that 60s slogan, the personal is political. Now, I'm not sure that's true in every situation, but I'm as positive as a person can be that Beethoven believed it. Now, how many of you remember Erich Hoffer, the thinker? So what is Hoffer's most famous book? The True Believer. Beethoven was living in revolutionary times. Hoffer wrote it in 1961. It became a hit. In 1951, it became a hit. It became a hit again in the 60s. And, you know, perhaps we are living in something that resembles a revolutionary time right now. But, you know, everybody was wondering during Beethoven's lifetime whether people would go to war, and eventually nearly every country did go to war. And that's not to say that that's going to happen soon here, but as always, it's like Russian roulette. Whether a society ultimately lives or dies, that's luck. So here's a man who's near the point of suicide, but he was a man who was near the point of suicide, who was always in love and could barely get any woman to stand him for more than the length of a lesson or a concert. He grew up with an abusive and alcoholic father. Then as a concert pianist, he became one of the most famous musicians in the world, not just Vienna, but Vienna was the musical capital of the world. And then he goes deaf. So this is the gift that would prevent Beethoven from having an adulthood just as traumatic as his childhood, which took away his entire sense of self. The French Revolution was a long, long time ago. We can't really judge the people who supported it or opposed it by contemporary standards. And supporting Napoleon Bonaparte, Bonaparte was a murderer of 10 million people in wars that were pretty much senseless. And Beethoven was clearly one of Napoleon's biggest supporters until 1803. But I would not say that that's anything like being a Nazi sympathizer. It might have been a little bit like a Stalin sympathizer, but does everybody know the story of Beethoven scratching out the dedication to Napoleon in the Third Symphony after crowning himself emperor? That might have been Beethoven's reaction of saying, I didn't expect Stalin, I just wanted Bernie Sanders. But Beethoven was clearly a huge fan of Napoleon, and like a lot of artists, he didn't know how to achieve the best practical approximation of his dreams, and he didn't really care. What mattered was the dream. Now, we artists, we're dreamers, and as a result, radical causes are always going to be catnip. It's true that it's a privilege to be an artist, but being in the arts is just about the hardest privilege that you can take. You probably went into the arts because standard careers make you feel like a misfit, How much more do you feel like a misfit when you realize the way artists are treated? You worked at your craft, you work at your craft hours every day without seeing another person. You see other people only when you audition, and most days they slam the door in your face. Inevitably, you sometimes have abusive bosses. The pay is crap. You're constantly in the presence of people using dangerous substances, and everybody's grouchy from working under the same circumstances. So when you're being an artist, you're being told every day of your life that everything you do doesn't matter to anybody. You're on the fringes. And by the standards of anybody who's privileged enough that you can have a career in the arts, you're considered a second-class citizen. You're not actually a second-class citizen. If you're in the arts, you're by definition a little privileged. But I'd venture a guess that among any kind of privileged career, except maybe athletes, there's more humiliation that goes into being an artist, you know, musician, writer, actor, painter, maybe even comedian, than goes into any other first world career. We are the Fredo Corleones of every stable family. And even if the humiliation is not that horrible in reality, it feels much worse because nobody else who started with our advantages has the same disadvantages. But then here comes a historical event that promises that if you devote everything in your life to its cause, which no sacrifice can be great enough for, the end result will inevitably be worth it. You know, so here comes the French Revolution and Napoleon 10 years after that. Here comes Bakunin and the 1848 revolutions all around Europe and Latin America. Here comes the theories of Marx and Engels. Here come Lenin and Stalin in Russia, Castro and Che in Cuba. Here comes the Arab Spring to Syria. And you can make just as long a list of right-wing revolutions. But in order for an artist to have self-esteem, they need to feel more than anything else like they're useful. So artists are just about always the first to sign up for revolutions. And we'll always imagine that a new society will value us much more than the old ones. And often they do. They value us so much that they put us in prison. Now, revolutions, now real revolutions, not like the Revolutionary War, which is just one landowner's taking up arms against another, but real revolutions, violent ones in which people rise up to overthrow the people in power, are often, maybe even usually, incredibly tragic events. Because, you know, in order to clean up the chaos that follows, just think of Iraq for a moment. In order to clean up the chaos that follows the toppling of a brutal regime, another one springs up that might be twice as bad. And that's exactly what happened in the French Revolution. First comes the guillotine, kills 20,000. Then the French Civil War, a million lives. Who wins any civil war? The general who has the willpower to kill the greatest number of people. So Bonaparte restores order. He issues a code of law that promises inalienable rights and dignity. And to bring people their inalienable rights, no sacrifice is great enough. So he begins a series of wars around Europe to liberate other Europeans from their monarchs. And then in the ultimate betrayal, he crowns himself Napoleon Premier, Napoleon I, Emperor of the French. Now, I'm sure you know what happens next. But the point is that he titles, you know, what was supposed to be a portrayal of Napoleon, he then titles in Italian Sinfonia Eroica, the heroic symphony, and underneath, to the memory of a great man. Now, every artist at some point does not have the self-esteem to get the inspiration they need from their own lives. So they need something that will promise them that there's a cause that's more important than themselves. And, you know, sometimes they even fall for right-wing revolutions. Can anybody think of some right-wing rockers in here? Because I can name at least 10. Gene Simmons, Meatloaf. And those are the ones you expect. But, you know, then, you know, Prince. Prince was a conservative Christian. Nobody knows this, but he was a Seventh-day Adventist, and he kept his politics secret because he didn't want anybody to know about them. Eric Clapton was, it was horribly right-wing. Alice Cooper, Brian Wilson, Brian Wilson, come on. This is a point in history when American conservatism is not that far off from being a mass movement, and I apologize to anyone in here who might be but I think that in order to grapple with history, it's important to bring contemporary politics into this. If you have anything to dispute that I say at any point, please feel free. There's no such thing as a trigger warning in my class. But the point is this. whether right or left, this lie of the mass movement inevitably turns out to be the most vicious lie imaginable. But artists, in order to have anything, the morale to produce anything at all, often need to believe in revolutions that will make them worth more, their lives worth more. So how does Beethoven create these musical metaphors for a revolution? Well, he starts by creating a symphony that's twice as long as a standard symphony. It has an opening movement that's longer than many Haydn symphonies. It has three subjects rather than the customary two that we talked about last week. And in Beethoven's mind, at least, the first movement, we have no way of knowing this, but in the first movement, it may be a musical portrayal of a battlefield. And it has a slow movement that is literally a funeral march. Is it a funeral march for Beethoven as a suicide note? Is it a funeral march for the millions of dead in the wars? Or did it become, in Beethoven's mind, a funeral march for the dream of the world where everybody who believed in Napoleon wanted to see? We have no idea. But I just want to play some of it. So let's start with the opening of this epic drama. Obviously, nobody ever began a symphony like that. You know, Haydn and Mozart both begin lots of symphonies with these loud, huge, grand gestures, but this isn't a grand gesture. It's a very terse one. It's like a middle finger at the audience, which says, you know, pay attention, you dolts, even if I don't earn your attention right away. Now, and also, in the mind of a listener who's in the middle of wartime, what might loud bangs sound like? Cannon, artillery, yeah. And remember, Napoleon was the master of artillery. He was, you know, that is how Napoleon won his battles. All other generals at that point can't concentrate on infantry and cavalry. Napoleon was the one who came up with the innovation that artillery was the most important part of warfare. Let's do this again. And let's listen to what he does next. That there's one note there, sort of like a severed ear in the middle of a yard. You don't know why it's there. That's a very, very sneaky diminished chord. You know, you don't actually hear it. It's very subtle. But what he does is he grows something out of this. So, you know, if this is a battle, you see what both sides choose as their weapons. On the one side, there's tonic chords, there's consonants, there's peace, ba-da-dum, ba-da-da-da-dum. And then on the other side, there's dissonance, diminishment, musical violence, and it's just a small opening volley. So what happens next? I want everybody to do something with me, okay? I want you to beat in three. Down, right, up, or down, left, up, doesn't really matter. But one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, and it's going to be a little fast in this. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. So let's play the first 40 seconds of the Eroica and see what he does. So you're not so, you know, the accents are supposed to be on the downbeat, yes? He doesn't put them on the downbeat. This is another musical metaphor for breaking with tradition, for something revolutionary. And half those accents, those are diminished chords. Ba-da, 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 ba. I'm not going to play it again, but those, he puts diminished chords on that. These accents are called syncopation. So, and like on a battlefield, it's supposed to be disorienting. But, you know, when you get back onto solid ground, what happens when you get back onto solid ground? That's a metaphor, maybe, for victory. Mm-hmm. So what else does Beethoven do that makes you think that this might be a battlefield? Well, there's an unmistakable thing that sounds a little bit like a horse galloping. So, and you can almost hear the Lone Ranger going, "Here comes the cavalry!" So, listen to this. And then you hear something that maybe sounds like a sneak attack. Hear how it sort of leaps out, you know, from nowhere. Well, let's keep going, because then you hear something that sounds like an infantry charge and maybe even some artillery. So then you get to what we call the first crisis. I don't know if there's any program to any of this, but this might be a point where it sounds, you know, a long series of diminished chords. And whenever it's not diminished chords, it resolves to the keys, just trust me on this, that are as far away from the home key of E flat major as you can get. So, I mean, I don't know what to say here, except that, you know, it sounds like defeat is possible. Now, we are clearly in defeat land now, and defeat land gets still more tragic. This leads up to a moment that Mahler, whom we'll certainly talk quite a bit about later, he called a moment like this in his Second Symphony a cry of despair. Okay, so, but just when things seem darkest, something amazing happens. It's almost like a musical metaphor for blundering your way into victory, which is something we Americans know all about. You can't hear it because the trembling, you can almost not hear it because the trembling violins are so quiet, but it's literally supposed to sound like a horn is coming in at the wrong moment. This was such a radical innovation that the first time it was heard, the first rehearsal, Beethoven's assistant yelled at the horn player thinking he was coming in at the wrong time. And even Wagner, it was so radical that even Wagner, when Wagner performed it two generations later, decided that he was going to correct it. You know, so it was too radical even for Wagner. So here it is. It's almost impossible to hear, unless you're right next to the orchestra, because it's so quiet. But let's now just play the denouement when you clearly realize that you've won the battle. The point is that Mozart's music is inevitably mostly quite happy, but even when it's happy, it sounds a little sad. It's sort of melancholy. When there was any unhappiness in Haydn, he balanced it with happiness, but Beethoven had to earn his happiness. Obviously, any good feelings of Beethoven's life came at a terrible price. So, you know, let's go back to those questions I asked earlier about the funeral march. Now, who, if anybody, is being buried here? Is it Beethoven, who still might be planning on killing himself at this point? Is it the millions of dead in the recent wars? Is it people suffering under monarchies who made all those revolutions and wars necessary? Did it become, in Beethoven's mind, after he composed it, a funeral march for the dream of the world he wanted to see, that Napoleon was supposed to give? Or is it just an objective funeral march and a piece of music? Now, whatever the answer, if there's a musical metaphor that's going on here, you can hear it all over the place in those different rhythms of the string accompaniment. Listen to the beginning, but listen to the bass and the cello particularly. Where else in Beethoven do you hear something like that string rhythm? Ba 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 ba, ba 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 ba, ba 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 ba. Exactly. So then we get to this amazing passage, one of my favorite moments in Beethoven, and no orchestra plays it well enough, and Bruckner wouldn't be possible without this moment, which literally sounds almost uncannily like a 21-gun salute. Now we're going to listen to the moment that everybody remembers in the Funeral March, which is the fugue. Now, who is generally associated with fugues? Bach, exactly. But when Beethoven wrote a fugue, it wasn't just beautiful music, it wasn't counterpoint for its own sake. Beethoven wanted to express something. Your guess is as good as mine what it expresses, but it's clearly something involving more than one person. It's like a collective outpouring of some sort, and it's obviously a tragic one. Maybe it's the procession at the funeral, but a fugue means that many voices are clearly equally important. It's like a community of voices who are expressing something tragic. And no matter what this passage means, you can still hear those military drums and the strings. Ba 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 ba. So. Let's just listen to the finale because, you know, the point is that, you know, the first two movements are obviously incredibly serious and heavy, and in ways that Mozart and Haydn never did. They'd probably have been fired if they tried. But, you know, the first two movements require a level of musical organization, of concentration that no symphony ever had to have. So he's creating a path that's nobody's ever tried before. So what does Beethoven do in the last two movements? He lightens up. You know, what does he do in the finale? He creates something that's almost deliberately a mess. You know, every section has barely anything to do with what comes before or after. It's like Beethoven saying, yeah, I know, that was brutal. Here's a dog and pony show. So he starts with what sounds like it's going to be another incredibly heavy grand gesture. Now, then he deliberately creates a theme that is so threadbare, it's barely even music. It's like an admission, it's a musical joke. It's like an admission that he's pulled a fast one on us. So let's listen in sequence. You know, he literally, it takes another 2 minutes of this before he even brings in a melody. You know, I'm not going to, we have way too much to get through for me to do anything. But the point is, you know, later he brings in the more heroic material. But the point is that in the last movement, he's juxtaposing the heroic with the comic, the high and the low. And this is something in Beethoven that Mahler would run circles with. Let's talk very briefly about the Fourth Symphony, mostly about the introduction. Does anybody remember the Shakespeare song from Much Ado About Nothing? I'm going to quote it. Don't worry, it's right in front of me. It's not from memory. Sigh no more, ladies, sigh no more. Men were deceivers ever. One foot in sea and one on shore. To one thing constant never. Then sigh not so, but let them go, and be you blithe and bonny, converting all your sounds of woe into hey, nonny, nonny. I could not possibly come up with a better description of Beethoven's Fourth. It's just a perfect piece of music. Certainly, it's Beethoven's most perfect symphony. It isn't a second too long. Not a note out of place. Haydn and Mozart would be overjoyed if they could write anything like this, and in many ways Haydn particularly did. The encroaching darkness we found in the second, it's still darker here. And all you have to do is hear the slow introduction, and you hear how far Beethoven's now moved from Haydn. Let's just listen to the beginning of Haydn 102, and then let's listen to the beginning of Beethoven 4. It's the same basic idea, and Mahler would take the idea a century later for the beginning of his first symphony, and yes, all three sound exactly like the beginning of the Star Trek theme. We'll get to that in a while. And no doubt that's intentional, but listen to how much darker Beethoven is willing to make the beginning of a happy symphony than Haydn is. Haydn's introduction is kind of dark, but it's not that dark. And compared to Haydn 104, this is nothing. So here's the beginning of Haydn 102. I've learned recently that that's a lot of experts' favorite Haydn symphony, and I don't really understand why. Haydn, you hear right after he makes that sort of vast, overtone-rich B-flat, threatening B-flat or B-flat. No, it's not minor, but it just B-flat. He has to balance it right away with these very sort of angelic-sounding violins. Now, let's listen to a very similar beginning in the Fourth Symphony of Beethoven, and let's listen now to how much darker Beethoven is willing to go before he brings us into the light. after Beethoven brings us back to the light side, the dark always keeps popping up in this symphony, but it's ultimately, it's an incredibly light piece of music. Schumann called it a slender Greek maiden in between two Norse giants, which strikes me as being not all that far off. But in order to talk about the other Norse giant, we have to talk more about Beethoven generally. Beethoven is, or he at least was, the center of the musical repertoire. Weirdly, he's not the center of the symphonic canon. In many ways, that's now Mahler. The Beethoven, which most people think of as Beethoven, the Titan, the fiery genius, who breaks the strings of the piano, who has the unconquerable self-belief and unbreakable willpower, who's larger than human, that's really only based on half his symphonies and only certain movements in them. Like the first two movements of the Eroica, or the fifth, or the Storms movement in the Pastoral Symphony, or the second and fourth movements of the seventh and the ninth. You know, that myth about Beethoven doesn't really do justice to the complexity of what he does or how Beethoven composed. And even more so, there's no way to do justice to talking about Beethoven without talking about his impact on all the composers after him. So in order to make sense of Beethoven, we have to acknowledge the fact that perceptions about Beethoven seem to have changed more over the last 30 years than they ever have since he died 190 years ago. Beethoven occupies a completely different place today in the musical discourse than he ever before did, because until roughly 1985, Beethoven was quite simply the indisputable center of classical music, maybe even of music itself. His music was more performed, it was more respected, it was more loved than any other composer, and I'm sure everybody in here but me can remember a time when that was unquestionably true. The third, the fifth, the sixth, the ninth, these symphonies, they seem to have as central a place in music as Hamlet and Othello and Lear and Macbeth have in literature. But all sorts of events have happened in the last generation that changed the way we view Beethoven. Some of them have nothing to do with Beethoven and everything to do with us. And we'll be talking directly about those in every single class. But there were three revolutions, or let's phrase it differently. There were three supposed revolutions in the way we perceive Beethoven that completely changed people's conscious views of how we listen to Beethoven's music. So of those three revolutions, only one of them, in my opinion at least, was a real revolution. The first revolution affected our perceptions of other composers much more than they did Beethoven. And the second wasn't really a revolution at all for Beethoven or anybody else. So let's talk about those two pseudo-revolutions for a moment with our first duality, historical instruments versus modern instruments. As we said in the last class, the orchestral instruments were somewhat different in Haydn's day, but they have much, much more in common with instruments 200 years after Beethoven than they do with instruments 200 years before Beethoven. Let's listen to three clips of the same piece, the last movement of Bach's third Brandenburg Concerto. Let's hear it the sort of romantic way it used to be done. So that's very nice, isn't it? You know, it's very proper, it's very prim, and it's something closer to an orchestra than it is to a chamber ensemble, even when playing fast. What I mean is, even when players like that play fast, everybody tries to get the most beautiful possible sound. Now, here's what it generally sounds like when it's played today. Thank you. So this is roughly 80 years before Beethoven, and the differences are fairly obvious. You know, string playing was, at least in a sense, a little bit more like fiddling, and often the music for strings would be correspondingly more rhythmic, as though it's country fiddling. The fundamental differences in the strings are that they're made from the guts of cats rather than metal. Yes, the guts of cats. And the bows were also slightly smaller. So whenever you see a bluegrass or Celtic fiddler choking up on the bow, that's because the modern bow is larger than the music that they're playing was written for. And while a larger bow gets a fatter sound, it's also a little bit more unwieldy, and it makes life a lot more difficult for violinists in fast passages. Trust me on that. We'll talk more about the difference in 19th century wind and brass instruments when it's time to talk about Berlioz. But by the time Beethoven rolls around, the string instruments are quite a bit more similar. You know, Beethoven's Violin Concerto is certainly a piece that can sound like country fiddling, but here's what a bit of the last movement sounds like on modern instruments. Okay, and now here's the same passage on the instruments of Beethoven's day. Okay, aside from a slight difference in pitch and a certain difference in tone quality, you can't really tell the difference. There isn't that much difference between the two. So, you know, what we call, or at least what we used to call, period instruments, you know, they have a real effect on how we perceive certain composers. Berlioz is a composer for whom the physical sounds he produces are the single most important part of his music. To hear Berlioz on period instruments can be a really illuminating experience, and we'll hear that very soon. But Berlioz would occasionally even write parts for instruments that don't really exist anymore. So orchestras have found all sorts of temporary solutions that really have very little to do with Berlioz's actual intent. There are all sorts of Baroque composers for whom hearing their music on the instruments of the period makes much more sense. Even Haydn, or at least early Haydn, becomes a totally different experience. But then there are other composers like Beethoven, Brahms, Schumann, Bruckner. You know, these are composers who seem almost completely unconcerned with the sound they project. Everything's just orchestrated in solid blocks, you know, strings here, then winds, then brass, then strings and winds together, then winds and brass, then everybody together, and then you start the same process all over. You know, they basically use the orchestra as though it's just a piano or an organ. Gives us a side note, because you'd be surprised how great music can be even if the composer has obvious limitations. You know, it's the same in rock music or anything else. The composer who was great at everything, of course, was Mozart. And even he has moments of weakness, even in his best pieces. But in the case of so many German composers, you know, whatever the instruments sound like is almost secondary, because they're just focused on other issues. And their genius is in sort of more theoretical realms, you know, form, design, harmony, melody. And in the case of Bach particularly, it almost doesn't matter which instruments play his music, long as they play the right notes in the right order. So let's now listen to a very different performance of the same passage of the Brandenburg Concertos. Thank you. I couldn't find the original on YouTube, but you know, this is the closest in sound to the original Wendy Carlos version I could find. I'm sure some of you remember that Switched on Bach record that sold amazingly in the late 60s, but Moog synthesizers never went away. They just went underground after they went out of fashion, and you know, a lot of musicians are still using them, most of whom are exactly 63 years old. The point is, whether or not you like this version of Bach, I guarantee that the person who created this arrangement spent many more days thinking about the sound of the music than Bach ever did. Bach, more than any other composer after him, thought exclusively about the notes. He thought linearly, and you know, so long as every line emerges with enough clarity, performance of Bach will still retain its Bachness, so to speak. Now, Beethoven didn't really think that much more deeply about sound. Insofar as he cared about sound, he cared about the contrasts of the sound, you know, loud versus soft, when to make the orchestra shout, when to make it whisper, and how to hold you in suspense or surprise you. So what this ultimately means is that so long as the sound in Beethoven has a physical impact on you, it doesn't matter how the instruments that produce it are designed. The design of the particular instruments doesn't much matter. The sound they produce doesn't much matter. And maybe even the balances between the instruments don't much matter, though some people would kill me for saying that. You know, I've heard a lot of Beethoven where conductors, you know, like David Zinman or, you know, any number of others who are not local, try to bring out instruments you don't generally hear. And the result is almost inevitably that you lose a lot of the physical excitement. What's important in Beethoven is the dynamics, or more to the point, the dynamism. Beethoven could only have composed the way he did if he had lived through the period he lived through. From a technical point of view, the most important contribution to making Beethoven Beethoven was the invention of the modern piano. And all you have to do is listen to the difference between a Mozart sonata and a Beethoven sonata to hear that. Now, Haydn wasn't a virtuoso pianist the way Mozart and Beethoven were, relatively speaking at least, and he wasn't, relatively speaking, much of a sonata writer either. And that's not to say that his piano sonatas aren't great, they're just not the front rank of his works. Haydn was fundamentally, he was a chamber musician and he was most at home probably writing string quartets. You know, Mozart was, in his way, obviously just as great a writer for the piano as Beethoven, and it's at least arguable that both of them did their very best compositions in various piano pieces, but they have completely opposite ways of approaching the piano. You know, try to listen to how these composers obtain the effects they do, and this brings us to our second duality, the Mozart piano versus the Beethoven piano. So here is Mozart's, the beginning of Mozart Kerschel five, or part of the first movement of Mozart Kerschel 533, one of his more famous sonatas. Thank you. here is part of Beethoven's Appassionata Sonata, which is much more famous. So, how did the composers get these effects? Now, to me, the appeal of this Mozart sonata is based on agility. The dynamics don't matter nearly as much. What matters is the flair of tossing off this dizzying array of notes and scales and sequences and arpeggios as though it's the easiest thing in the world. But the few years that separate Mozart to Beethoven, the dynamic contrasts on the piano in Vienna become twice as wide and therefore hundreds of times more important. Beethoven exploited this change not only by fundamentally basing his music on dynamic contrasts and using the element of surprise they generate to play the audience, you know, like a piano, but realizing that you could get still more dynamic contrasts by making the chords much fuller. Mozart's music is based on melodic lines that sometimes you hear. They go a million miles a minute, like a bird flying through the air. You know, the lines rise, they fall, they intersect, they cross each other, they pass each other around, and they do this all at three times the speed which any other composer of Mozart's time can. Now, Beethoven could obviously go finger to finger with Mozart on any virtuoso effect, but in Mozart, the virtuosity isn't self-conscious. It's just what he does naturally. He is the world's most talented composer. In Beethoven, he is self-consciously out to thrill you. The effects are much more fiery, but the reason the effects can be much more fiery is because they start with a bass of these enormous, full, rich chords that allow him to scorch the earth. Mozart seems to fly through the air while Beethoven explodes. And the reason for this has to do with the way that music travels through the air. You know, the sound produced causes the air itself to vibrate. What that ultimately means, and never mind how, we'll get to that in future classes, is that every note you hear is not just one note, but a series of higher notes vibrating along with it. And when we get to Bruckner and Brahms, we'll talk a lot about that, and I'll show you all sorts of physical evidence of it. But what happens is that when you play a very full chord, like so many of the chords in Beethoven, every note in the chord causes every other note played to vibrate still more. So ultimately, you get these chords that hit you in the solar plexus every time. And that brings us to duality number three, and the second pseudo-revolution in Beethoven performance. Instructed tempo versus harmonic tension. Some of you may know that Beethoven left a series of metronome markings for all his symphonies that, you know, for 150 years were mostly ignored. Most of the inspiring Beethoven performances you've heard in your lifetimes were played at tempos much slower than they're usually played today. Let's listen to a few phrases from two of Beethoven's most famous symphonies in the opening. You know, one is the kind of comfortable tempo that people used to take in an era when the fashion was to play Beethoven according to the dictates of however long it took the harmonies to vibrate, and, you know, often at the expense of the dynamics and the rhythm and the form. And that was based on a kind of once fashionable musical analysis we don't need to talk about. But, you know, it clearly works better for Wagner than it does Beethoven. The other is at Beethoven's specified tempo that many conductors now, they strive for and they often fail to get. So each of these will be played in performances that are separated by a half century. So here's part of the opening of the Fifth Symphony. That's clearly how we used to hear it. That's you know, how it's generally thought of. So here is how it's generally played today. So now, here's the opening of the sixth. Here's how a traditional interpretation would play it. And here is a much more, shall we say, originalist interpretation that's at Beethoven's specified tempo. Almost seems like different pieces, yeah? But there's a problem. One of the fast performances was from the 1950s, and one of the slow performances was from the 2010s. The truth is that some people have been advocating for performing at Beethoven's tempo since the very beginning, and so many people seem to think this is a new phenomenon. Even in the mid-19th century, Wagner was complaining that Mendelssohn's performances of Beethoven were much too fast, and one of Beethoven's students, Ferdinand Hiller, would complain that lots of performers rushed the tempos in Beethoven. So clearly, there have been people hearing a kind of perky Beethoven that sounds a lot more like Haydn or Rossini since the very beginning. But the difference is that in the 21st century, the practice of trying to reach Beethoven's tempos is the norm. Now, personally, and this is completely my editorializing, I think the single most damaging thing to happen to Beethoven's reputation is that people insist on playing him much faster today than they used to. It used to be a problem that most people would perform him too slowly, but they performed Beethoven too slowly because they over-revered him. Now, many conductors and instrumentalists play him quickly because they under-revere him, and they don't really value, properly at least, this amazing tradition we have. I'm sure some of you are thinking, who cares right now? Because the average audience member thinks that the particulars of one performance to the other don't matter. But from the point of view of the people on stage, we see the impression a piece of music makes from one performance to the next. And often, though not always, audiences blame the composer when the performer just didn't do a great job of selling it. Now, we'll talk about cases of that later in class, but we, the performers, know that whether or not the music makes any kind of impression, at least sometimes, it's the performer's fault and not the composer who just wrote a boring or nonsensical piece of music. Now, there are a few musicians who can make something musical out of a jumble like Beethoven at top speed, but there aren't many. And the result often of these faster tempos is one of two things. Many of today's classical musicians have techniques that are 100 times more secure than they've ever been, so it's almost become a science. Now, I can point to all kinds of performances where the performance is completely robotic. You know, those full chords that are supposed to hit you in the solar plexus, they have less time to vibrate, so the physical impact is not nearly as strong. Now, speed doesn't necessarily mean excitement any more than slowness necessarily means profundity. But the other result, maybe an even more common one, is that a lot of musicians can't handle the faster tempos. You know, orchestras often, they have to get a Beethoven symphony ready in just two rehearsals, if that. And a lot of orchestras play in giant halls that need a big orchestra just to fill them with sound. And the orchestra then becomes too large and too unwieldy to stay together. So over the course of a 15-minute movement, like the opening of the Eroica or the Ninth, you know, the tempo just creeps slower and slower and slower. Now, lots of people used to give theories about why the metronome markings of Beethoven should be disregarded, like the fact that he was deaf, so how could he have known what his music sounded like, or Beethoven's metronome was faulty. Now, there is one subtle, extremely elusive problem that seems to have eluded tens of thousands of musicians for a century and a half. It presupposes that Beethoven was a moron. He clearly would have known if his metronome was faulty, and even if he was deaf, he would have known what's playable to musicians and what isn't. So in its place, I'm going to submit to you my own personal theory. I don't think Beethoven meant his metronome markings literally. He knew that they were basically unplayable, and he knew that musicians would disregard them no matter what he did. The metronome markings are his way of challenging musicians. It's a way of saying, however fast you think is comfortable for you to play, play it a little faster. You know, take a risk, chance the impossible, do more with these pieces than you think you can. And that kind of risk-taking is what gives Beethoven the vibrance he needs, but if performers make speed into a scientific measurement, they automatically lose the passion that Beethoven needs. But if they stay at tempos in their comfort zone, the audience will also never hear what's shocking about Beethoven. So now that we've spoken about risks, this brings us to the next duality, revolutionary versus romantic. Now, in this duality, we have to talk about the third and very real revolution in how we perceive Beethoven. We think of Beethoven as the ultimate romantic, who was putting his angry feelings on the page. But what if he wasn't trying to be a romantic at all? Let's listen to just a couple small excerpts from pieces written in France or after the French Revolution, some of which weren't performed for two whole centuries until a musicologist unearthed them in the 1990s. Let's take, just for example, this small passage in the last movement of the Seventh Symphony, and then let's hear it alongside a passage from a piece called Triumph of the Republic by François-Joseph Gossec, or Joseph, I don't know how to pronounce it. He's a French composer nobody's talked about in 200 years. So the first was Beethoven, the second was Gossec. It's fairly close, but that might be a coincidence. Now, let's listen to this fairly simple choral arrangement of a piece whose lyrics are, "We all vow, sword in hand, to die for the Republic and for the rights of mankind." I don't think I need to play the Beethoven piece that sounds like the first few measures of that, but here's a slightly more complicated version of that in an orchestral piece by Luigi Cherubini, a very famous composer in his time, who still occasionally played. This is called the Hymn of the Pantheon, which commemorated the war dead in the French Revolution. Now just wait for it. Once you hear it at a slightly faster tempo, it makes more sense, I think. But I know exactly what that sounds like without my saying anything. And in case these examples don't seem quite close enough, let's listen to this. This is the Hymn to Agriculture by a composer named Lefebvre, who wasn't even particularly well known as a composer. In his day, he was better known as a teacher. So here's the Hymn to Agriculture. And now, of course, here's the finale of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony. Now, and so the similarities keep getting closer. Now, let's take the third movement of another composer who hasn't been a celebrity in a few hundred years, Étienne Méhul, and his Symphony No. 1 with just a little bit of commentary from the still controversial English conductor, Sir John Eliot Gardiner, whom I think is more of an insightful observer than a great conductor, though he does get magnificent playing, and we'll contrast it with a similar passage in Beethoven's Fifth.
What I find fascinating about the last two movements of the Fifth Symphony is that they're based on, or at least their origin, the seed, is a French seed from two separate composers. If you listen to the scherzo, the pizzicato in the strings and with a bassoon, it seems to have a direct derivation in Méhul's G minor symphony, where he wrote for pizzicato strings, roughly contemporary with the Fifth Symphony, perhaps a little bit before. Thank you. Mayhew wrote a scherzo for pizzicato strings. Now that's very unusual, nobody had done that before. Beethoven is doing exactly the same thing, more or less at the same time. Had he heard Mayhew's symphony? Had he seen it? We don't know, but there it is.
So I'm a little less convinced by this one. Maybe it would be more convincing if Gardner played the two excerpts at the same tempo, but God forbid he not follow a metronome marking. Beethoven was working on the Fifth Symphony for 4 years, and it seems more probable to me that Mayhew heard from someone that Beethoven was doing a symphony with a pizzicato passage in it, and with something like that in it, and he said, I can beat Beethoven to the gate. I can make a whole movement of pizzicato, but who knows? You know, it could be one, it could be the other. I agree, though, that it's doubtful that neither of them could have done it without one of them thinking of it. They couldn't have come up with the same idea in the same year. But finally, let's listen to the Hymn of Liberty by Roger de Lisle, who wrote La Marseillaise. And now, like many of these French Revolution pieces, it was written as a kind of propaganda. You know, it was written both in a complex version to be played in a concert hall and then in a simpler version for choruses to sing in towns. Convinced, obviously, by this one, but hear it in the context of the last movement of Beethoven 5. Liberté, liberté. I don't know. Now, Beethoven clearly loved the French, and, you know, the French clearly loved him back in the same way that the English loved Haydn. And now, with many composers, there's often a foreign country or a city that appreciates them better than he ever was in his native land. you know, with Haydn, it was clearly London. With Mozart, it was, believe it or not, it was Prague. With Berlioz, it was St. Petersburg. With Mahler, Amsterdam. Now, after Beethoven died, it remained to be seen whether any living composer could sell out tickets, shall we say, at a public performance after he died. Now, in some ways, that had never really happened before, except for the occasional revival of Handel in England. But a year or two after he died, a French orchestra put on a series of concerts at which they played the symphonies, and the concerts made such an impression that it was clear for the first time that a dead composer's work was never going away. And once that happened, the stage was set for Mendelssohn to revive Bach in Germany. Now, Berlioz was in the audience in those French performances, and it was perhaps there that he realized just what could be done with the orchestra. A year or so after he heard it, he premiered the Symphonie Fantastique. And the Fifth Symphony made such an impression on Berlioz's teacher that the teacher claimed that when he went to put on his hat, he couldn't find his head. Now, you know, this obviously, you know, begs a lot of questions, you know. By the standards of the 21st century, would all of this be considered plagiarism? You know, what does it mean that Beethoven, traditionally the great artist of artists, seems to take themes from other people? And does it mean everything in the common myths of Beethoven are completely wrong? I'm sure you all know the common notion of the Fifth Symphony opening resembling fate knocking at the door. But now that we hear the seed in the music with the lyrics, "We all vow sword in hand to die for the Republic," does this mean that fate knocking at the door is completely wrong? Does it mean that the pieces are all about Beethoven's political opinions? Do you think that this music can ultimately be about his personal life, or is it just his music, or is it some weird melange of all three? And if so, then how does he combine them? So there's, of course, a ton more to say about the Fifth, but along with the Third and especially the Ninth, you know, the Fifth will come up so much in future classes, you know, when we talk about Brahms, Bruckner, Tchaikovsky, Mahler, Shostakovich, even Schnittke, you have to bring up the Fifth Symphony. So let's leave the Fifth aside to talk about the symphony that I would take over just about any other Beethoven symphony, including the Ninth, and nearly any other symphony ever written. You know, I really think that next to the Ninth, the Pastoral is Beethoven's greatest. And for me, the Pastoral is at least arguably the greatest, in part because it's so, relatively speaking, disorganized. Beethoven's Fifth, like the Fourth, is just about perfect. The Fifth is actually his shortest symphony, and there isn't a single wasted note in the whole thing. It's the maximum possible impact in the smallest possible suitcase. But there are all kinds of passages in Beethoven 6 that are clearly filler. And it's like when you wander around in nature, you're not really going anywhere, but you're just happy to be there. You know, it's like a soundscape in which even when your attention isn't necessarily riveted, you're amazed by the effect it has on you. And during a performance, you know, hardly anybody pays attention in the second movement of the Pastoral unless they've had a few cups of coffee. Yet it has, for my money, the most beautiful orchestral music Beethoven ever wrote. It's like Beethoven is lulling you into a state in which you have to be alert to appreciate those things in nature that make nature beautiful. So the only people who really experience the most beautiful things in a park or a forest or a lake, those are the people who are really looking for them. You know, the Fifth, the Ninth, the Eroica, you know, they're very dramatic pieces of music. They're full of events. But the Pastoral doesn't build drama in the same way. It's one of those pieces that just flows on like life. You know, a little comedy here, a little tragedy there, you know, the same way that The Marriage of Figaro does, or a novel like Middlemarch, or Robert Altman's Nashville, or The Simpsons. You know, it's like life in that it just sort of is. Now, the Beethoven who had undergone the crises that, you know, of the Third and the Fifth Symphonies, it's not here. It's not in this symphony. And, you know, he clearly used that hymn to agriculture in the last movement of the Pastoral. But whether or not the Eroica or the Fifth Symphony were about Beethoven's political views or about the personal crises, the political Beethoven who felt the weight of the world on his shoulders, it's not present here. Here we just have, you know, those sort of brief impressions of the vague things that flit in and out of your consciousness when you're experiencing what you're experiencing in moments when you're really and truly at peace with yourself. So this is the one time Beethoven supplies anything like a program in his symphonies. the note he supplies for the first movement is the awakening of cheerful feelings upon arriving in the countryside. So he gives almost a cinematic beginning in which you can feel the cheeriness awakening, and maybe he's just arrived at some kind of breathtaking landscape. And remember, this isn't 2017 when you simply can get into a car and drive out Route 70 and see a bunch of mountains. In 1800, when you lived in Vienna, going into nature was as much of a life event as a trip to Vienna would be for us. So imagine how you would feel if you hadn't seen any mountains or valleys or forests in a few years, and then you see one. What would you feel like? You can already hear in that flute line something that sounds like a bird, but then the bird gets strangely more specific as you acclimate to the surroundings. You begin to notice things perhaps with new eyes and ears, you know, and at a certain point you can even perhaps hear the quiet and the stillness. Let's listen to the coda of the first movement. You suddenly get this strange clarinet and bassoon melody that is clearly not from a traditional Western scale. It's in what we call the Lydian mode. It's almost like Beethoven is telling us that we're so far out of our own experiences here that the folk musicians don't even play the same scales Beethoven does. And, you know, maybe you're very grateful for the experience. So let's talk now about the second movement, maybe my favorite in all of Beethoven, the scene by the brook. Maybe you begin by hearing the oscillation of the water. And then maybe you hear the breeze against your face and the violins, or maybe a frog in the horns. So the symphonic structure really doesn't start for a good minute and a half in this piece, and when it does, it just sort of sounds like the chirping of birds or crickets, and
then he just repeats that sort of oscillating, flowing water over and over again as though to lull us. And many listeners, if they've had a long week, they inevitably take a nap sometime in this movement. I'm sure you hear there, you know, there is a second subject, but the second subject is so long, you know. Beethoven is so rarely a great melodist, and yet here it's like an infinite melody the way that it is in Schubert. I'm sure Schubert was influenced by this. Now, we're going to skip ahead to the portion for which a good part of the audience is inevitably asleep, because it's the most beautiful part of the symphony. Now, like in nature, you only notice moments like this if you're looking for it and you're ready for it. If you lose your concentration, you don't even notice it. It just gradually gets quieter and quieter and quieter and more inward and more inward and more inward. It's like you're taking a nap on the grass and you're just at peace with the world. And like the most beautiful moments in nature, they're always too short. Thank you. So then, you know, some people at this point have taken a beautiful nap. And if you've fallen asleep, either on the grass or in a tent or in the concert hall, there's the gentle song of birds to wake you up. And then comes the dances of the third movement, the merry gathering of country folk. You know, these are the rougher types than you ever associate with in Vienna. They're lower social class, worse manners, and therefore more genuine people. Now, they clearly like to dance, and the melodies they dance to are not very sophisticated. But then, of course, comes the single most violent movement of music Beethoven ever wrote. It's a very realistic, terrifying storm in a time and place where it's very difficult to take cover, in which you get all sorts of effects. Now, in a great performance of this movement, you can figure them all out for yourselves. Thank you. Let's just listen to the last movement, the Shepherd's Song of Happy and Thankful Feelings After the Storm. You know, was the storm from Beethoven's personal life? Was it that peace seemed at hand after an invasion in Austria from Beethoven's hero? And that peace, by the way, would be shattered a year after this was written. Now, whether or not Beethoven was a more political composer than people had originally thought, he also tried mightily hard to be a decent human being, even if he often, maybe even usually, failed. And if the Fifth Symphony sounds like he achieved some sort of definitive victory over his demons, be they the demons of the world or his own personal ones, then he has the mental presence at this point to be thankful for it. All I know is that this is some of the most beautiful music ever created, and it sounds, if anything, like a prayer for gratitude, and, you know, nothing more I can say can enhance it.
Thank you for listening to History of the Symphony. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn so you never miss an episode. Find this and other podcasts at audio.as21.com. This podcast is hosted on Podomatic. You can support this podcast and other work on the AS21 Podcast Network at patreon.com/AS21.
Thank you. Copyright 2017, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?